Okay, this is podcast number two.
And what's today?
What is today? I have no idea.
Today's the 21st.
21st of September 2006. That's right, right? Okay, so I thought there might be a handful of people who don't know who I am, since we occasionally get new people in here. My name is Terry Haverkost. I'm a PhD student under Scott Gardner here at the museum. And this seminar, I knew exactly what I was going to do the first day that we showed up, and it was going to be something about modeling parasite transmission. And then apparently I got Dr. Janovy all excited, and so he wanted to show off his modeling program 2 weeks ago. And so we heard that seminar, and I'm kind of glad he did, because I was looking at some of the published papers about how to model parasite transmission, and it looked like a lot of differential equations and calculus. And I really was not looking forward to that. And so this was a much easier opportunity to test some theories, and I'm really glad that that happened before this seminar. So I'm using the same program that Dr. Janovy used, a program called Quick Basic. This almost predates DOS, but not quite. So it's a very, very simple language, but if you know how to ask the right questions, it can give you very complex results or very complex answers. So it was kind of fun to play with. And this was, 2 weeks ago when he gave his seminar, so I've been just fiddling with it for about 2 weeks. And I have to say in this that, and I think for the past three seminars, before I even start, I say something to the effect of that this isn't really the end product, and these usually end up being something that I do for a handful of weeks, and then by the end of that time I have to present what I have and not the actual answer to the question that I started with. So originally I always thought seminar was supposed to be that you show up with definitive answers and this is how I cured cancer or something, but it really ends up being this is where I am at this point in time because I've only had this much time to work on it. So instead of keeping you guys up here and building you up just to let you down, I'm going to start you down here. And so if you're interested or whatever, you can kind of ratchet yourself up to the excitement level, but don't start up here. This is 2 weeks of intense computer modeling boiled down into however long this seminar lasts. Please go. I unplugged. That's right, I did. You can just yank that.
Did you dump it that over?
Yeah. Nice. Technological sophistication. Okay, so why I like models. These are fun because it's kind of, depending on how you look at it, it's kind of just lots of lazy work, depending on who you are and if you're getting paid to do it. Because how much actual work are you doing? When I think of modeling parasite or parasite transmission, when I think about studying that sort of thing, I think about going out into the field and collecting hosts. If I have an idea as to what the life cycle already is, I can collect the definitive host, I can collect the intermediate host, and I can expose them to various amounts of something or expose them at various temperatures or at various parameters and see what happens. This, we kind of do that, but we do that in a virtual world. So we're really not sweating or lifting a finger. We're just kind of saying, well, in this particular world, the temperature is this or that, and I just don't know if I consider that work or not. And also, another thing is that anything is possible in the lands of ones and zeros. You can create an environment where everything always works, or it works only a certain percentage of the time, and you never have to account for the fact that something got loose, or something ate something else, or something completely killed off your entire sample. And so, I don't know, you never have that biological filter to worry about. Okay, so my model was, Dr. Janovy talked about a trematode life cycle. I'm going to talk to you about a cestode life cycle. And the cestode is Praniplocephala macrocephala. This is a tapeworm that lives in the small intestine of Microtus fulvus. Oh yeah, and I put this in here. Here's 6 pages of code. This is the entire thing. This page and this page. And I didn't print off copies for everybody because I didn't think everybody would enjoy that. So I printed off one copy, and if anybody looks at this by the end of the day, then this is a success. But this is what I spent the last 2 weeks doing. And I probably spent 1 week doing just this section. And then once I really got going and figured out what I was doing, then I spent the last week writing the next 4 pages. So once you kind of figure out what's going on, then you just go really quickly once you figure out how to ask it certain questions. So it's fun if you're into computer stuff. And I left out all the describing the arrays and the printing statements and all that sort of stuff because I felt like it. So here's a definitive host of this particular system. This is a vol, what we call it, the common name for any Microtus species or almost any species in this family. You can sometimes call them vols. I just like this picture. So what the first thing we have to do is we have to digitize all of our animals. So I digitized the vol and I put it into the concept of a life cycle. So here's my vol and I'm gonna make some cool stuff, and here's the intermediate host. So the life cycle of this thing. We start out with a tapeworm adult, and it lives in the small intestine of this vol here. And then if I have my arrows right, okay, I do. These eggs get laid in the feces, and from what we know about these life cycles, these little mites, these grass mites, from the superfamily Orobatoidea, I think is where the current taxonomy says they are. These are grass mites that accidentally ingest these eggs, and given a little bit of time, another stage develops. I'm pretty sure it's a cysticercoid stage that develops in their body cavity. These, in turn, after that certain amount of time, a vol will be eating grass and accidentally ingest these grass mites. So this is a very simple two-host life cycle. So there's not a whole lot of, as far as complexity goes, the complexity is not on the level of the life cycle and multiplication of generations. There's one egg, which would equal one cysticercoid. So we don't have to worry about the complexity of the model in that respect. Okay, so just so everybody has a picture, I pulled these off this morning, I think. This would be a diagrammatic view of what the perfect paranoplacephala, macrocephala would look like with testes and ovaries and vitellaria and whatnot. And here we have a picture that I took, must have been a year or two ago, of the scolex, the head region, and then each of these proglottids.
What's the vitellaria there?
The vitellaria, I'm pretty sure, is right here. This
and
guy.
The ovary, yes.
And the ovary would be this fan shape. Testes are all these little guys out here. This particular species is known. These are excretory canals that run all the way through the entire strobila, and this particular species is known to have these excretory canals are just humongous. Sometimes they'll take up half of this entire proglottid, depending on where you are. So we have female organ here, male organ here. We're not 100% sure if those have to go into different, if those self-fertilize or whatnot. But there's pretty pictures. Okay, so the challenge here is how to turn that life cycle that we saw before into a computer code. So what we do is we can think of this in terms of a metaphor of creating what we'll call a virtual infection chamber. And so you create this space of 100 by 100 units, and you randomly drop eggs into it, and then you randomly drop mites into it, and you assume that these mites, in this particular part of the model, we'll assume that any time a mite runs into an egg, it gets infected. And the mite's range of movement we can limit to a certain window size, which we'll call an exposure window. So here I have a diagram of this. So we randomly drop all this stuff on there, and then we decide how much these mites can move within this environment. So if the window size is 10, this guy would get infected with 2 eggs, and this guy would get infected with 1 egg. And similarly, if the window size was 20, or my nice scale up there, you have 2 extra eggs up there. So how does this look? Actually, in code, this looks pretty easy. You just kind of give these XY coordinates, and then you give them random numbers for these, and this kind of makes it an iterative process. And then if these XY coordinates are larger or farther apart than this window size, whatever it is, then you don't have an infection. But if the XY coordinates are smaller than the window, or if the X coordinates are smaller and the Y coordinates are smaller than this window, then we have exposure and infection. Because in this case, exposure and infection are the same thing. Oh yeah, and then, okay, so they're moving around and they're eating eggs. I got bored last night and made that. Okay, so this is what happens if we make up some numbers, and all these graphs that you're going to see are averages of 3 trials. So this is the only time I actually wrote that down, but all of these are averages of 3 trials. If we say in this virtual space, we drop 1,000 eggs and we drop 100 mites, and then we give these mites variable window sizes, variable movement, variable spaces for movement, this is kind of what happens. And you see that in between, looks like pretty much 4 and 10, it looks almost the same in that there's not a whole lot that aren't infected. Most of these mites are infected. Some of them have 1, but they go all the way up to 9. And so the whole crux of this is that if you get a big enough window, one mite is going to eat up everything in that window, and another mite is going to eat up everything in its own window. But from what we know about the biology of parasitism, this is kind of what we expect, this kind of looking graph. So we'd expect most of them to be uninfected. Parasitism can be considered a rare event. So most of the things that we'll run into in nature are uninfected. And then anywhere from 1 to 3% maybe might be infected. So we get a much less number infected with one parasite. Abundance is the number of parasites. Very few have 2 parasites, so on and so on. So when I start messing with the parameters of this model, I'm going to pick mainly on the windows 1 and 2. And this is the same windows that you saw in that previous graph. So this is the same number of mites. This is always going to be 1,000 eggs. It's always going to be 100 mites. But I'm just going to start tweaking things after that. So what I wanted to do was kind of shift these curves a little bit and see if I could make this mimic what we know about nature. What if we assume that, I don't know, 90 to 99% of the mites here are uninfected? We want to get this way up to 90, and maybe we could make this shift way up to 90 if we had the same parameters. So that was my goal for this. Okay, so how would we do that? Well, first we could say, well, let's just say right off the bat that just because it's exposed, it's not infected. So we could give it, let's just give it an 80% chance of infecting in the first place. And so the easiest way to do that is just make a random number and say, if it's exposed and, you know, it's less than 80, it's 80% chance, then it's infected. And this was my first, you know, bit of messing with this thing, and I was really proud of it. And then I see the graph after 3 trials, and it doesn't really look all that different. And I was really disappointed. So our dotted lines here are our old graphs. This is the standard throughout. The dotted lines are always the old graphs. Solid lines are always the new. It helped a little bit with the window too, but really, just functionally, there doesn't seem to be a really big difference between what I did before and what I did now. So I said there's got to be another layer of complexity we have to add to make sure that this looks like what we should find in nature. So let's see what happens if we have a density-dependent problem with infection. So the higher the abundance, the more parasites you have, the less likely that you're going to be infected with any more parasites. That seems pretty good. So here's the curve that I created to say, if you have this number of parasites in you, you're this likely to get infected. So the more parasites you have, the less likely you get infected. But up to two parasites, it really doesn't matter. I thought that seemed reasonable because I was making this up as I go. What does this look like in code? You just say, okay, well, you make up random stuff and you generate another random number and you say, if this random number is there, then okay, 40% chance. That still doesn't mean that this couldn't always get 9 and 8 infections. It just means the probability is low. What does this do to the graph? This does absolutely nothing to our graph, which I was extremely disappointed about. So at this point in time, I'm thinking, I'm just not taxing these mites or these eggs enough. I really need to create some level of complexity, some level of pressure or something that really fires these guys to make them look like what I want them to look like, because that's what modeling's about. It's about what you think should happen, and then make your data fit what you think, and then call that nature. Okay, so I'm going to develop some sort of density-dependent host death. I'm going to say that if you get infected with more parasites, the more likely they are to kill you. And I thought, this looks pretty good, because we know, because we know from, at least from acanthocephalon data, the only stuff that I've read about this sort of thing, we know that if we infect them with 4, 5, 6 cystic ants, then they will die from it. So overinfection kills an intermediate host. So that's kind of what I base this assumption on. So 1 and 2 parasites doesn't kill the host, but the more parasites that you have, the more likely you are to die from them. And in code, this looks almost exactly like the other density-dependent factor that I made with a random number and some go-to signs for other stuff, because that's the only way I figured out how to do this. And for the data, this does not look any better. And in fact, in these particular runs, this is an average of 3 runs for each of these, in this particular run, there was actually no host death. So nothing died from this. And I'm thinking, well, maybe the problem is that windows are too small. Maybe the problem is that I'm just not dealing with the right type of parameters that would affect such a small window size. So let's see what happens if I use those parameters, but I make the exposure window bigger. So this is what I get if I make the window 5. So here are all of my different levels of complexity. My pluses equal more complexity. And if you can see here, they almost all look exactly the same. The only difference is my most complex thing here, this guy with the blue diamonds, half of the mites ended up being dead. But still, with the other half of them, they still ended up with 3, 4, 5, 6 parasites, which I'm pretty sure is not how it works in nature. So I'm still getting very few of them that are uninfected. In this particular system, every single mite is infected. And at this point in time, I'm pretty sure I started shutting down. Because what do you do? All you can do is start tweaking things and say, well, I think that my theory is right. So what if I just start tweaking the probabilities and seeing if that helps at all? So here is my old density-dependent infectivity curve. I said, what if I make this a little bit stricter, a little bit harder to get infected, so I create more probabilities or different probabilities to make it harder to have multiple infections? Because multiple infections of parasites with intermediate hosts is usually pretty rare in nature. So what does that do? It's a little different. With the window 5 here in the gold, it doesn't really do much. And this particular one that I've got up here, I do have the new differential infection, but I did not include the density-dependent host death correction. It seemed to help out with the window 2 here, but I think with these 3 runs, It looks like the window two is actually more strict than if you have a window of only one. So this might just be random running of a model, and so I don't know if that really is reflecting what actually you're going to see. So if you run that three more times, it's probably going to look a lot different, is my guess. Okay, so at this point in time, I gave up. And if you notice, going back to that life cycle, you actually go back and you have mite infections and then you have vole infections. If you'll notice, I never actually talked about the vole infections because I gave up before I got there. I gave up because I couldn't even get the mites to look like I wanted them to. But, and it seemed that no matter what I was doing with that particular code, the voles always looked the same anyway, so it's not like any of this data was actually going to change what the voles look like, which I was really not happy about, because I had questions really early on that we talked about over beer at Barry's, and I figured out those questions. How can I, if I have mites that have six parasites, how can I make sure that they make it to the next stage of the model so that I can infect a vole with six parasites and not just one parasite? I figured that out, which I was really excited about. And I figured out a different way to work with density-dependent infectivities versus exposures. And I worked that with voles. And so there's lots of new, if you're computer science people right now, you guys are salivating, because there's lots of new, exciting code that I've got written down, two different ways to control populations. And it sounds like great biology. But after a while, I started thinking, okay, am I really getting anywhere? When you work with models, it's a lot of, here's what I think happens, or here's what we know what happens in theory, and what if I tweak this theory? What if I tweak this to say this happens? What if I tweak this to say this happens? What if I tweak this so this runs this way and not this way? You start what-ifing yourself, because that's what modelers do. If anybody knows a modeler or is a modeler, maybe this isn't true, but this is what I think happens. You what-if yourself crazy. You start creating things that maybe you think happen, or maybe you heard once, or maybe you read once, and you decide that, okay, this now happens in my system. And you're just creating what you think should happen in nature. And so I started realizing that I'm what-ifing myself to death, but then I realized, you know what? Other people, if I wasn't laying on really thick the really biting comments I was having about my modeling experience, other people would think that maybe I'm doing a really good job. And maybe I could actually what-if myself into a job by telling them about my spiffy model. And so I think I'm going crazy, but other people might think, wow, he's really onto something. This guy's really smart. And that's another reason why I love models, because you look really smart to people that don't, well, okay, so the people that don't know any better, yeah. So the take-home message. My model really doesn't match what we think we know about nature. So this, maybe my numbers are wrong. Maybe my ratio to eggs and mites is different. Maybe the pool of eggs is smaller. Maybe I only have to deal with 50 eggs or 2,000 mites. I gave myself room to do that in the code, but I didn't ever actually use it. And this is the same thing going on to what I said before. Maybe my differential equations are wrong, and maybe I need to tweak those until we get what we think we should see in nature. But at this point in time, and this was also the point in time that I had given up on the model, I thought, you know what, am I really wrong? This is what we know about most parasitic infections, that most individuals are uninfected, and then there's a smaller number that are infected, and even smaller number that are infected with multiple infections. Do we know this happens with cysticercoid abundance in orbatted mite populations in nature? No. This has never been done. Maybe in the lab once or twice you threw some eggs into an orbatted mite population, but those people got lots of infections because it's not a real environment. So then I rationalized to myself, maybe I'm not wrong. Maybe this is the way it actually happens, and it just doesn't look like the way I think it should, But in truth, if I were to go out and sample this stuff, those are the numbers I would find. I would find 70% uninfected instead of 90. So maybe I'm not wrong. Maybe I'll just say I'm not wrong. So what do we need from this? We need a more intensely studied life cycle to kind of know what the abundances are and to know what the numbers more likely represent. So this is where I knew Matt was going to be gone. Dr. Bullock was going to be gone. And he could have enlightened us with how this system works with frog lung flu, so to speak. So then I started asking, well, am I even working on the right organism? This is like the journey of every dissertation. Am I even doing the right thing? Am I even going the right way? Maybe I should just scrap it and start working on frogs because they're easier to catch. They're more numerous. They don't digest their food as quickly, so you can look to their stomach and you can see exactly what they've eaten based on what time of day it is, all that sort of stuff. And with mammals, it's a little bit harder because mammals are, well, first off, they're harder to catch. You're less likely to catch them. And because they regulate their own body temperature, they have a higher metabolism. You can't look and see exactly what they ate. And from what I know, mammals are not parasitized as heavily as frogs and snakes and that sort of stuff. So maybe I shouldn't have even included this. But this was me questioning my existence. Okay, so Monday night, 10 o'clock, I'm getting discouraged. I forgot why I wanted to model parasite transmission in the first place. So what I said is, well, what makes a good model? How could I test that this was actually a good model? And I thought, well, okay, it's a good model if I can test it, if it gives me a hypothesis that I can go out and look and see if it's true or not. So then I say, okay, so what do I want to test? And this is where I'm rectifying my existence again. What do I want to know? Okay, well, I actually, at this point in time in my life, I want to model that if I go out in nature, I want a model to say, based on what I know about parameters you've given me, you will find the parasite here, or you will find it here. So I'm actually switching gears completely, and I'm looking for a model that does nothing about what I just talked about for the last half hour. I want to know about models that model the spatial aspects of the infections. I just want to know presence, absence. Would I find it here? Would I find it here? Do these occur in nature? And this sort of stuff isn't too difficult. Here's a graph from a publication that I hopefully will have done by December. You look at all of the different species of Peranoplacephala and all the different species of tapeworms that live in arvicolid hosts, or not even arvicolids, or anoplacephalids in general, that entire family of tapeworms. And you plot them on a graph based on where they're found. You plot the temperature and you plot the precipitation, and you start to get curves that look like this. And you start to think to yourself, okay, there has got to be some sort of predictive power in a curve that looks like this. These ones with the X's don't really count because those are subterranean, so we'll deal with the ones that don't have X's. So we look at that and we can say, all right, based on this, I should be able to make predictions and test my hypothesis of presence, absence of a parasite just based on this. This really simple model stuff. If temperature is over this, precipitation is over this, and we throw in elevation or something is under this, then it should be present. If not, then it's not there. So here's an example of where you get data like this. And here's an example of what a model would look like this if you made a model that looked like that.
What was the last picture?
This is precipitation, average precipitation from 1961 to 1990 across the United States, or North America. So that was just eye candy. And this would be a model that would look something like that, with the green being absent and the blue being present. So we can make a spatial model and it would look something like that. But that wasn't even the question I wanted to ask. I mean, I wanted to know specifically, if I was to go to point A, and here's my GPS location, I want to go into this field, and I want to go into this section of this field, and I want to know if they're present or not. So I realized that this wasn't really the scale that I wanted to work with, because there's another question that was bothering me. local scale. Okay, so here's to orient ourselves. Lincoln is down here. This is a map I pulled off the internet. And Scott, Dave, this might look familiar because when I first started here, I was trying to go catch voles, and I wasn't having a very easy time. So we went to Arbor Lake Wildlife Management Area, which is just north of town. This is 27th Street. Here's 77. The interstate is right here. You just go here, take a quick right, quick left, and here's Arbor Lake. It actually extends maybe a mile or two north of here.
That's a great big wetland.
Yes.
Viewing platform.
Does it have? Yes, it does. This is the parking lot right here with the viewing platform. This is also part of the Salt Creek habitat. So this right here would be a salt flat, and there's a lot of salt flats around here where you can find lots of tiger beetles. I caught a couple of those things. They're hard to catch, tiger beetles. Wow. Anyway, when you guys went out with me the very first time, we threw traps in a bunch of different places, but there's a ditch right here. This is when it's a wetter part of the season. This is open water. And right across the ditch here is a spot where it's kind of moist soil. There's cattails in certain places, but a lot of it is
sedges,
there you go. And we threw, 10 traps in there, and we caught 4 or 5 voles. And in this particular spot, I'm finding 80, 90% prevalence of, this is a different species, but it's the same life cycle as far as we know.
That was my prediction.
Yeah, we found 80, 90% prevalence of this parasite. So it's there in 80, 90% of the voles that we caught. And it's there in numbers of 2 and 3. So there's multiple infections of these voles. And I could not get, to save my life, multiple infections in voles of my model. So this somehow is completely different than everything that I know personally about parasite transmission. How can I create some sort of model that gives this an 80-90% prevalence? At the same time, you go about 10 miles north to a place called Jackson Wildlife Management Area. I spent almost 2 weeks trapping at this place, 4 different locations, 4 different habitat types, 4 different ground cover types, and I could not find this parasite to save my life. I found pinworms. That was it. No tapeworms whatsoever. And it's just really amazing how you can say, okay, well, how come this is so different? How come in one place they're everywhere, and in another place they're nowhere? And so now, on a much smaller scale, we need to look at this and we need to say, what are the parameters we should start looking at to see this sort of thing on a smaller scale? Well, we can look at historical prevalence, presence. We can say, okay, well, when was the last time this was disked? Or when was the last time this was actually, when was this created? And maybe that has an impact as to why they're not there yet. Maybe it's soil moisture, plant cover. Maybe it goes into different hosts that aren't there at the second place. Maybe it's the proximity to open water. Or maybe it's just the soil moisture, which they might be related anyway. How dense the vegetation is. There's a bunch of stuff that we can start throwing into our new model to figure out what is going on. Okay, so yada, yada, yada. Oh, and this is the other really interesting thing. With all of the voles that I found infected with this sort of stuff, I have only twice, out of the over 100 voles that I caught 2 summers ago, I've only twice found what we think of as their intermediate host in the cecum of these mites. And twice out of 100, which means either that the mites churn this stuff out very quickly, they don't run into it, it's even more rare than we thought of before, or there's something else going on with this life cycle. How are they getting 3 or 4 parasites in there, but the interaction or the accidental ingestion of these mites is so low? How is that possible? So this is another level of complexity and 15 more lines of code that need to get written about this. So where do I go from here? I dropped the model for a while, and I realized that I actually need to do research, and so I can be happy with myself. There's a couple things that, if you're interested, there's some really good stuff to look at. The work of Stunkard 1939, or Freeman in the late 40s, early 50s, they actually kind of sat you down with their papers and said, this is how you raise mites, this is how you pick them out, and this is how they do in a laboratory setting. And it's really not all that hard. And so I think this is definitely something that could be done. And Freeman worked mainly working on the life cycle of Monocacystis americana and taxonomically, is that correct? Okay, so Monocacystis, that's U.S. is plural, americana, the A is plural. Are those two?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, but the name doesn't
have to match. Oh, they don't have to match? Oh, I thought they did. Well, that's how much I should have learned. But then I also, when I was looking up other papers, I started running into readings when I was looking at the Proceedings of the University of Connecticut Biological Society or something. I started running into the work of Lowell Goetz, and this guy is a workhorse when it comes to habitat use of Microtus. And I'm pretty sure I figured out from reading a couple of his papers that what he did is he's made himself a greenhouse. And he has these greenhouse tables that are about 8 foot by 4 foot, and he varies them, maybe based on elevation, based on water, based on how much wood or debris is in there, and he looks at habitat preferences in voles. And I thought, well, I think this is as close as I'm going to possibly get to simulating the natural environment. Throw in some voles, and then throw in just a massive amount of mites, and wait for everything to kind of equilibrate, and then throw in an infected vole or something and start seeing if I can induce some sort of natural life cycle in this unnatural setting. So I started off wanting to be able to model parasites and their transmission, and I end up with a plus one for my projects that I should do after or if I graduate from this place. This is one more thing I have to do in order to get closer to my Nobel Prize. But that's as far as I go. Oh, yeah, and then two blank screens. So that's as far as I got.
So very well. Why don't you go to all of it. Go up there to that first bunch of graphs that you started showing. Yeah, that bunch along in there. So one thing that if you go out into nature, I don't know where the data are or whether there really are real data about, or at least a lot of it, about infection rates of intermediate hosts. But I know from Lee Hardin's work back in the 80s that those little toads that were an inch long ate 4,000 prey items a week. I mean, he actually did those enclosure experiments with the dissections. And these were enclosures about the size of all these tables. But he just put the stuff out there on the sand and put 100 toads in there and then came back and dissected them at certain lengths of time. He calculated, first of all, that they got one tapeworm a week and ate 4,000 prey items a week that were small enough to get into a mouth this big. So, I know that if Brent were here, he would also talk a little bit about the challenge of actually going out in the field and finding an infected intermediate host. And I think all that Cedar Point stuff from Cedar Creek and Devon's Ranch, and that is so atypical of real nature, that, and especially, those whole systems are so constrained and so confined, and those aquatic environments are so sort of sealed off by all that prairie around them, that I know that those things are not really right. I remember, for example, Scott Snyder collecting a bucket of stuff at Nimitz and bringing it back into the lab and letting it sit for a day before he actually got in and started looking at it for Metasecharia and invertebrates, and they were all infected. And then he started, he realized that he had also had a bucket full of infected snails. So in that day, in that little confined 5 gallon bucket, you know, the cicaria had just penetrated everything. And it was very different from what's going on in nature. So I do wonder, you know, of all the stuff that you could actually quantify, in theory, a person could go out to Arbor Lake and collect, say, repeat samples of vegetation and put them in a Berlizzi funnel or something and calculate numbers of mice per body. And you could do the same thing with soil. You could do all that stuff. It might be, you know, you could at least begin to put numbers into some of those things. But the thing that impressed me about, and I would almost encourage you when you're really bored sometimes to go back and follow up on it, would be where you actually started putting in limitations on the number of parasites in there and deaths of hosts and all that stuff, see whether that made any difference in the structure of the population of your parasites. Because those two ideas are what I would call standard ecology. I mean, those are the very first questions that people who are not parasitologists ask and have never worked with parasitic systems or symbiotic systems of any kind. That's the first question they ask. Oh, how many does it take to kill? You know, is there, obviously there's density dependent. Why haven't you taken that into account? Or obviously there's competition between parasites. Why haven't you taken that into account? And it seemed to me that what you've done was the same thing that shows up on a lot of these models, and that is you've taken those processes into account and shown that it makes absolutely no difference at all in what you've observed.
So maybe that's exactly what I'm supposed to be getting.
Well, no, I think that you're clearly on to something.
Just the fact that everyone asks about it and means absolutely nothing should be documented somewhere.
Absolutely. Now, does it make any difference if such and such a process happened just because people who don't study these systems and who don't study disease transmission make the assumption? And that, I think, is reasonably important. The other thing you might think about is, you know, that particular setup has the arena where the mites are and the arena where the eggs are. They're congruent. So fiddle with that a little bit. You can make those two arenas not 100% congruent. And you can multiply the number of eggs or the number of mites many, many times over. And then you can make the bulbs come back into the bigger arena.
So only have a 50% overlap.
Yeah, so there's some of that stuff.
So kind of take microhabitat variation into account.
Yeah, good.
The only problem with some of that is that we don't know that mites are the intermediate hosts.
Well, yeah, that's what you assume.
It's an assumption, but we don't know. Nobody's ever found them. Also, thanks, John.
See ya. Thank you all. I've got a meeting.
See ya. Another thing that you have to consider is the fact that these little egg packets, the eggs are coming out in nice little packets, which is about 5 millimeters long by 2 millimeters wide. And they're all concentrated in there. So there's just little packets, and there's thousands of eggs or hundreds of eggs or tens of eggs per packet depending on the time of day that the cica met.
And that was the other thing that I was starting to work out is the clumping of the eggs. See, if you got exposed to one, then that kind of